This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Dallas, Texas, at the 25th World Travel and Tourism Council Global Summit, right here in the heart of Texas, and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it throughout the air or throughout the show. And speaking of that, you can also reach me on Twitter. My handle is @PeterSGreenberg or Facebook, facebook.com/PeterGreenberg. So much to talk about at this 25th anniversary WTTC. For those of you who are longtime listeners of the show, you know we broadcast every year from the WTTC. This is only the third time in the 25 years of the organization that the actual summit's been held in the United States. Last year was in Madrid. The year before that was Hainan Island in China. The year before that was Abu Dhabi. It's always a fascinating sort of a two-day summit of the world leaders in travel. We're talking the CEOs of airlines, hotels, cruise lines, rental car companies, every facet you can think of, and they're here talking about stuff that I learn from and then share with you about the trends in travel that are good, bad, and yes, sometimes even ugly, and what it means on the world stage. After all, the numbers are staggering. It is the largest industry in the world, travel and tourism. It's responsible for nearly 10% of global GDP, and in some countries, it's actually higher than that. It's one out of every 10 jobs. There are about 93 countries out there that totally depend on travel and tourism, and if they didn't have it, they'd have to fold up the tents. I mean, we're talking about some serious and staggering numbers. And yet, having said that, we have incidents like Brussels, Paris, Istanbul, Ankara, that basically upset the chain, that disrupt what should be people's will and eagerness and enthusiasm to travel, see the world, to learn, to exchange with others. And it's an interesting response to see how the travel industry itself adjusts to the changing times, or maybe the times aren't changing at all, they're just happening more frequently. What are they going to do about it? That's just one of the disruptions. There are other disruptions caused by consolidations and mergers. We just saw earlier this week the conclusion of at least the beginning, how about that? The conclusion of the beginning, I wasn't making a mistake, of the acquisition of Virgin America by Alaska Airlines for about $2.6 billion. What will that mean? Where will it go? Because the combined airline will become the fifth largest airline in the United States. And before you get too excited, there are only about five airlines in the United States now. You know, we've gone from eight airlines competing for 88% of the market share to four airlines, and maybe now five, that own it. And other than Frontier and Southwest, well, Southwest's one of the five now, other than Frontier and Allegiant and a few others, maybe Spirit, I think we've seen the end of the mergers and consolidations. Can that at any time be helpful to consumers? And my argument is no, because the airlines are practicing what they call capacity discipline. That's another term for shrinking. And that's why every plane you're on is full. So you're seeing fewer flights with occasionally more seats on the plane, but not available seats. And airfares have nowhere to go but up. I mean, think of this statistic. In 2014, there were 29 million more people who traveled than in 2000. Pretty impressive, right? Now get ready for this. In the same period of time, the airlines removed 156 million seats. So that coupled with lower fuel prices, ancillary fees, means the airlines are making more money now than they've ever done in their history. So the real question is not whether or not they're having a windfall. The real question is, what are they going to do with it? Some airlines are investing in new aircraft, new systems. They're not investing in better food, and they're not investing in more comfortable seats, especially in the back of the plane. All they're doing is trying to reduce pitch size, reduce width, and You know, I like to say that there's first class, coach class, and last class. And a lot of us are finding ourselves right now in the back of the plane. Interesting stuff there. And then, in the meantime, speaking of other disruption, there are airlines outside the United States that are coming in and picking up markets that are underserved. Those are the markets that are underserved domestically. Think of the markets like Cincinnati, Ontario, California, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Memphis, you can go on, that have seen dramatic drops in service, in departures and arrivals. And, you know, it's a ripple effect because you don't have airlift, you don't have business. It's not just whether or not the newsstand at the airport can sell newspapers. It's you don't have business because the businesses who are in those cities can't move their executives. And you've reached the tipping point. And then it comes down to price. And this is where all common sense goes out the window. You can't look at this in a sensible way. It is now cheaper to fly from Omaha to Oman than it is to fly from New York to Boston. Now, the New York to Boston flight, last time I looked, has an actual airtime, in the airtime, of 38 minutes. Of course, since you're going from LaGuardia, you're on the ground for 38 hours. But the point is, it's a 38-minute flight, and it's more expensive in some cases than New York to Nairobi. This is making no sense at all. We're seeing airlines many of you have never heard of before, like Norwegian, Edelweiss, and others. WOW, have you heard of WOW? Coming in and using certain hub cities to create a network from cities that you would normally not think of when taking a long-haul flight. For example, you can now fly nonstop from Las Vegas to Zurich on an airline called Edelweiss. You can fly nonstop from New York to Bergen, Norway on Norwegian. You can fly nonstop from Los Angeles to Stockholm on Norwegian. And the fares are unbelievably low. Speaking of unbelievably low, you want the wow factor? Try WOW. It's a brand new airline out of Iceland that is flying people from Los Angeles and San Francisco and many other destinations to Reykjavik. And their introductory fare was $99. And if you want to continue on to Europe through their hub in Reykjavik, tack on about another $135. So for under $300, by the way, these are round trips. You get to go to Europe. And some airlines are even doing nonstop service with stopover privileges, meaning you fly to Iceland on Iceland Air, the established long-term airline, and they give you two free nights at a hotel if you're going on with them to Europe. So all sorts of opportunities there. And yet, if you're living in Las Vegas, it may be more difficult to fly to Chicago. But you can fly to Zurich, and from Zurich you get to go everywhere. So we're living in interesting times, and what's particularly interesting about this is for the first time in 40 years, the U.S. dollar is at an all-time most powerful place against so many foreign currencies that it's a great buyer's market for us if we want to go overseas.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm honored to be joined by an old friend of mine. We've traveled the world together. He has the distinguished position of being, I think, chairman of the airlines of the world. I can't keep count anymore. I mean, of course, I met him when he was doing Gulf Air and out of Bahrain. And now, of course, he's the CEO of Etihad, based in Abu Dhabi. But it's not just Etihad, is it?
Pete, good to see you. It's a number of airlines. It's Alitalia. We're a major shareholder. Jet Airways in India, Air Berlin in Germany, Air Serbia, Air Seychelles.
As I said, I can't keep count.
And Virgin Australia.
I mean, that's a big deal.
Well, it's an aviation group. We operate over 700 aircraft.
But it's not co-chairing. You actually have equity positions in these airlines.
Well, one of the challenges of airlines, it's very difficult to get access to markets because of bilateral rules, foreign ownership.
Slots.
So by investing in these airlines, it's given the ability to integrate our networks, access to market. But on the flip side, we're able to tackle scale. So we're able to look at costs, we're able to purchase systems together, work with SAP, IBM.
Just IT alone.
IT, MRO, pilot training, a whole range of aspects we tackle as one.
Wow. And Alitalia, to me, was, I would think, your most ambitious acquisition, if I can say. because my history with Alitalia meant that the words Alitalia or the letters Alitalia stood for all land in Tokyo, all luggage in Athens. You with me on that?
Maybe you and I come from different eras. But you know, I started back in the airlines in 1975,
right.
And Alitalia then used to fly to Australia, and
sure.
It was one of the brands
in
the 60s and 70s. And
although I will tell you this, you know what they used to do with smoking and non-smoking on Alitalia? Smoking was on the left and non-smoking was on the right.
Well, they weren't the only airline that did that in those days. So, look, what's more important is that in investing just over 12 months ago in Alitalia, we went through extraordinary due diligence set very important condition precedents, because in investing, we have 49%. We wanted to win.
But
this is a brand that we are turning. And
nobody thought you could do it.
Well,
I mean, you thought you could do it, but I'm saying the world outside saying Alitalia was an airline that even the Italian government didn't even want to go near.
Yeah, but you know, when you start doing your due diligence and looking at the DNA of the business, and the DNA of the brand is strong, the people of Alitalia are good. They're passionate for the airline, and it's like any organization. When you don't give them the training, the tools, the investment to win, in our business, that's like the IFE, the interiors, the catering. And what we've done is reworked the airline, new brand, new interiors, IFE, training, and the people are ready for it. So we're very excited.
And it's still an Italian airline.
It is an Italian airline. If you think of Italy, when you think of Italy, you think about service, you think about style, you think about fashion. And that's what Alitalia should reflect. And next month we launch the new uniform of Alitalia.
Now we're talking.
And
okay.
That's really the final phase of the reinvestment and the turn. So, you know, from the livery to the interiors to in-flight entertainment, all the aircraft have Wi-Fi, new lounges, new catering proposition, and now the uniform. So they have the ingredients to win. And in aviation, it's about safety, as you know. As importantly, when you're on board, it is about the service proposition. So I think when people travel Alitalia, they're going to be surprised and delighted.
And the new uniforms?
Wow. But I can't tell you because it hasn't been launched yet.
Very Italian. Will they have sweaters around their necks? Will they, hello? Would they be doing that? Very, very flaring.
Look, you'll have to come to the launch and you can see for yourself.
Okay. But in this world, you know, you and I talked about this once before, and it bears repeating. And at this conference today, even Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker talked about this, the concept of preclearance. I mean, it's a concept that is so brilliant, and it's been around since 1952. And there's still people out there who think it's not a good idea. How could it not be a good idea?
Look, it's a great idea. We have pre-clearance in Abu Dhabi. And if you think, you know, post 9/11, obviously the focus, as one would expect worldwide, on screening people, profiling, and that's a given. But for some people, it's quite an experience. So to have that in Abu Dhabi as a crossroad where you have people coming from the Middle East, from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, you have U.S. customs officers who have real empathy for the region, it works. So from a service, from the ability to turn people, it's better to turn them in Abu Dhabi for them to go back to India or Bangladesh.
Sure. If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I am a passenger.
James, we're just last left off. We're talking about pre-clearance. The whole idea is you actually clear U.S. customs in the country that you're leaving from, and the same security protocols are in place. You're going to be at the airport anyway. Why wouldn't you do it then? And you get a head start on who's on the plane before they even get on the plane.
Look, you know, the Department of Homeland Security have been outstanding in developing the program. It gives the guest on board the aircraft that reassurance that the profiling has been done before they arrive in the US. And then from a service perspective, you're actually at the curbside within 30 minutes. You know yourself, sometimes you walk into a US airport after a long-haul flight, and it can be a one and a half hour wait in the queue.
You don't walk in, you stumble in.
Well, your words. But, you know, what is great, because we offer this obviously from Abu Dhabi into New York, into Chicago, into Washington, into San Francisco, LA, and Dallas.
I must say, I have friends of mine who are over in the Gulf, and they might be in Doha, they might be in Dubai. They'll make a separate point of leaving from Abu Dhabi because after an 11-hour flight, they don't want to wait 2 hours in the United States. First of all, their bags connect, they connect. I mean, it's a win-win for everybody.
Well, look, it's a great initiative, and you would have seen recently that Homeland Security are also very keen to take it into Europe, which they're evaluating at the moment.
Yes.
So I think for travellers, for inbound tourism to America, it also generates more traffic for people to have that confidence to know they're being cleared at the point of departure, and it is a very smooth entry once they arrive as a domestic customer.
You know, one of the themes of this particular summit, which is only the third time in the history of the WTTC that's been in the United States, is called Travel Beyond Boundaries. What are the boundaries that challenge you?
Well, obviously, for any airline CEO in today's world, you know, security and safety is our number one priority. And with the, you know, tragic events we've had recently at Brussels Airport, it means the vigilance becomes, you know, far greater. So the ability to work with various authorities to ensure that, you know, we do have the proper passport checks, security controls, whether it's passenger cargo, whether it's catering, you know, all aspects of the chain.
Whoever has access.
That service an aircraft. And, you know, that is the number one focus and priority.
And you mentioned that, but also isn't it just the airport itself before they ever get to the plane? I mean, you know, the knee-jerk reaction after 9/11 and again right after Brussels is, okay, let's expand the security perimeter around the airport. And then only people who have a valid boarding pass, we check the vehicles out there, we check the bags out there, no meters and greeters, just those passengers come in. From an efficiency standpoint, works for me, but at the same point, there's always that double-edged sword of at what point do you compromise, you know, hospitality for security or vice versa?
Well, you know, obviously the focus for any airline operator is always going to be security first.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I think travelers today also appreciate, in fact, seek that those proper security protocols are in place.
Now, about a year and a half ago, I was over in Abu Dhabi and you said, I want to meet you tonight. You have to come over and see something. So you snuck me into this building. You called it, I believe, the Innovation Center. Am I right?
Indeed.
All right. And you said, okay, you can't tell anybody about this. Come look. And that was the residence.
Correct.
That was what you built in the front of the cabin of the A380, which is basically a three-room residence that you sell as a ticket.
Look, when we looked at the 380, we had placed the order nearly 8 years ago. And at that time, we felt if we could do something in regard to design, and from an aviation point of view, it's about the seat count, the number of seats on the aircraft, it's the weight for range, it's getting the design right to ensure you can bring that in premium, that privacy. And one of the first things in our work group, we said, why don't we do a penthouse? We started with a penthouse before it became the residence. And we held focus groups in New York, in Abu Dhabi, in Sydney, in London.
You need a focus group to figure out that somebody would like say no to a penthouse?
Well, it was more about what do you like and don't like about travel and what would you like to see in a cabin? And we have, in fact, filmed those focus groups. And when you replay them and you see the end product, you can see how much of that feedback we took from our regular travelers into producing. But, you know, the great thing about the residence is that we're selling it. It's innovative. What we
Now, you were selling it, what about, was it, how much is it now?
It's on U.S. between New York and Abu Dhabi, it's about $45,000 U.S.
For one or two?
One or two.
So listen, as I said to you many times before, if you're spending $45,000 for one on that plane, in that residence, you are a loser. You need a partner.
Well, I'm sure you'd have a partner, but let me tell you, it's much more effective than taking a private jet. So you get the comfort of an A380. You don't have to make a stop if you do on a private jet. And it's a lot cheaper than a private jet. And you get a butler, you get your own shower, you get your own bedroom, and a menu that you design.
And by the way, when they say menu that you design, I was on one of your flights once, and the guy said, would you like to have some breakfast? I said, okay. He said, do you have any eggs? He goes, what kind? I went, what kind? Just eggs. He said, no, what kind of eggs? I said, okay. And what would you like with the eggs? I said, mushrooms? He said, what kind? I said, oh, stop. But you actually stock that plane that way.
Well, you know, we have chefs working on board the aircraft. They come out of five-star establishments.
They're actually chefs who are trained as flight attendants.
Correct.
And as opposed to flight attendants with a hat.
Correct. And they come for 2 or 3 years. They come out of the kitchens. They fly. They go back to the kitchens. They bring their personality into the cabin. But that's innovation. If you go back to that innovation center, because, you know, we have the food and beverage managers. We have the nannies on board the aircraft. It's about
you and I know about the nannies.
I know.
My baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Joining me now is an old buddy of mine. We've traveled all over the world together. in many cases, for these summits. Going back, 15, 20 years at this point, he's the chairman of the Travel Corporation of America. He's also the vice chairman of the World Travel and Tourism Council. Brett Tolman, how are you, sir?
Great. And you, Peter?
I'm good. You know, we find ourselves, as the Chinese like to say, in interesting times. You know, it's one thing to look at the travel industry, as we already know it is, as essentially the largest industry in the world, one out of every 10 or 11 jobs, nearly 10% of global GDP. All those are very interesting figures to talk about, but most people listening to the show don't always relate to that in their daily lives. In fact, even though so much of it is related to their daily lives. And then you have something that happens like Brussels or Istanbul or Paris. And you know, the immediate reaction from people is, of course, to stay home, to close, you know, to basically circle the wagons and not go anywhere. We've been through this so many times before. You would think, like the Europeans before us and the Irish, especially in Northern Ireland, it's sort of like they get it. It's almost, it sounds so cynical to say it, but it's almost part of the way of life these days. It's part of the cost, if you will, of doing business, terrorism.
It is. And it's very unsettling. And it's very hard to convince people to travel. I was standing on the border of the Golan Heights last week with my family, looking out at one of the Syrian towns across. And
which you could easily see.
Absolutely. And it was quiet. My wife wasn't particularly happy, but it was a remarkable reminder that the world is an incredible place to see and experience. And sometimes what you read in the media or you think in your minds is very different to actually what's happening on the ground. You see what's happening in Tahrir Square when you're looking at the news about Egypt, and then one or two blocks away, everyone's sitting calmly reading their newspapers.
I have
and drinking
to tell you,
coffee.
I personally experienced that. We broadcast this show from Tahrir Square. I was there right before it. I was there during it and right after it. The same thing happened. I was in Nairobi, not by design. I happened to land in Nairobi the morning of the shootout at the mall. And there I was covering it for CBS. And yes, we were dodging bullets, and it was crazy. And five blocks away, people were leaving to go on their safari and go out to the Masai Mara, and everything was just fine. But images that are visual are very powerful. It certainly the worst four-letter word that starts with F in the world of travel is fear. And, you know, no amount of public relations or press releases takes the place of on-the-ground experience. You just had it on the border with Syria. And you came back alive.
Right.
Right.
Certainly one message is to stay away from where you're traveling to, because obviously you attract it. But seriously.
It only took about 3 minutes and 26 seconds for the provocative message of Brett Tolman. Thank you, sir.
You know I love you, though.
I know you do. But in all seriousness, what right. can you do? I mean, I go back to 9/11, and I think the travel industry did a very bad job after 9/11 because they went to focus groups. And the focus groups were asked a ridiculously stupid question, because focus groups usually get asked ridiculously stupid questions to which there are only one answer, and they're all set up, right? And the question was, will you be traveling this year? Of course, the resounding answer was no. They forgot to ask the second question, do you want to?
Right.
And people didn't think they could. They wanted their security blanket. They wanted their blankie. They wanted somebody to tell them it's okay, you can go. And nobody did it. And the travel industry and the economy of the United States, for that matter, and the world suffered at least a 6 to 9 month just period of nothingness as everybody just basically shut the doors.
Devastating. I think we've all learned a lot from there, and social media helped significantly. We're very careful in the first week or two post a tragic event like the ones you mentioned to be very sympathetic and supportive of the local communities that have had terrible losses. And then in time to start reassuring our travelers and encouraging them to reconsider not traveling and to provide insights on what's happening in the ground, photography, and so forth, to hopefully help them convince themselves to not change their plans.
Well, to put this in perspective, I mean, I can say you're the chairman of the Travel Corporation of America. Nobody really knows what that means. So these are many different companies that you own and manage across a wide spectrum of operations and experiences. So give me an idea.
So we have about 30 companies. We operate in over 60 countries. So escorted tours and guided vacations like Trafalgar and Insight Vacations, river cruising such as Uniworld, luxury hotels around the world from London to Ireland to South Africa.
And the thing is, it's almost a domino effect. If you have a regional problem, it all starts to fall apart, right?
Right.
I mean, you have operations in Egypt, and you know, I was out there with some of your people on the Nile, you know, with 44 boats in the water and only 4 that were operating. I mean, that was very sad. You know, from a buyer's market perspective, from a consumer perspective, it's a great time to go because you own the Nile. But it's not going to solve the problem if only one person goes.
No. And what you say and your messaging, I think, is fantastic. It reinforces that it's not all bad and you can't listen to all the media. We had an amazing story just the other day of a 93-year-old calling us 2 days after Brussels saying he doesn't have the time to wait, so him and his 91-year-old wife want a book and want to come to Europe. But we are seeing change in terms of people are staying away from France, they're staying away from Italy, but Spain, Portugal, Ireland, the business is up significantly.
You know, talking about that 91-year-old or that 93-year-old, the one five-letter word that bothers me the most, not just in the world of travel, in the world of life, is later. Every time you use that word in a sentence, you either don't do it as well or you don't do it at all. And so when people, even when people say goodbye to me, they say, I'll see you later. I said, you'll see me soon. Later doesn't compute, you know, because it means never, right?
Right.
And every time, you know, people say that word, they are building in a situation that's going to be self-fulfilling in a negative way.
And I just ask everyone to, you know, be careful in their thinking. I apologize to your listeners if this upsets them, but living in the United States, as we both do, I live in L.A., you're on the other coast, we have approximately 12 shooting deaths a weekend. 100,000 people die in this country due to accidents in hospitals, and therefore the mathematical chance and probability of dying from a terrorist attack here or elsewhere in Europe is so mathematically small compared to staying at home. And therefore, you know, we need to be so careful about how we think and trying to be pragmatic. But as you said, that four-letter word fear is very hard to overcome.
I mean, I can think of probably 50 destinations right now that if most of my friends, who, by the way, I think are well-educated and experienced and sophisticated, if they heard I was going to any one of those 50 destinations, their immediate reaction would be careful, be safe. I drive on the San Diego freeway.
There you go. Keep that going. This is Flight 372 on SWA. The flight attendants on board serving you today. Teresa in the middle, David in the back. My name is David, and I'm here to tell you that shortly after takeoff, first things first, there's soft drinks and coffee to quench your thirst. But if you want another kind of drink, then just holler. Alcoholic beverages will be $4. If a Monster energy drink is your plan, that'll be $3, and you get the whole can. We won't take your
cash. My next guest, I never see him where I live. I see him where, well, actually I only saw you once where you live. He's based in Barcelona. I saw him in Florida, and now he's here in Dallas. He's the chief executive officer of something that most Americans have never heard of, called eDreams, or the website is Odigio.
The website, actually, it depends upon which country you are. So we have many different brands, but here in the U.S.
Well, first, let me introduce you. It's Dana Dunn.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure always to see you.
Yeah.
So the company, actually, we have many different brands. So we're a conglomerate. We're kind of, let's say, in Expedia, mostly European-based, right? Even though we cover 44 countries, the brands that would be eDreams, would be Apodo, Travelink, Go Voyage, and Liligo. And they're
okay,
mostly
so by the way, no one in this country has ever heard of them.
That's right. That's right.
But what's interesting is I happen to think they're a great alternative, especially if you're trying to book travel outside the United States within other countries in Europe, because you told me this once before. How many websites are you checking every day? I mean, what are you scanning?
So we cover over 450 different airlines. And then
many of them you've never heard of, by the way.
Absolutely. But if you're really out there to find the best fares, and also if you want to do it, at the right time. So it's not just fares, but also leaving at the right time, landing at the right time, depending upon whether you want to have a stopover or not stopover. We actually check 9 billion different elements to put together itineraries per hour. 9 billion
per hour.
Yeah, because what we can do is we have a unique technology that's proprietary to us, and we actually take for long distance travel, not short distance, but long distance travel, if you're really going kind of, let's say, 10 hours plus, you're flying, let's say, from New York to Hong Kong, you know, some people don't mind a stopover. And they, what they can do is they can save, let's say, hundreds
of
dollars.
And you give them a stopover.
We give them a stopover.
Okay, so here's my question for you.
Yep.
I need to get from New York to Cape Town, right? Now, when I go on the normal websites of Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, whatever, of course, it's based on price. So the cheapest price comes up first, and you see that you're taking a 72-hour flight because it's going in the completely opposite direction. You're making 18 stops, and basically, you know, the paramedics are waiting for you when you land. So you don't do it that way.
So we do, but we don't offer the 72-hour stop.
You.
But what we do is two things. One thing is if we have, because again, we're the largest in flights. Other companies focus on different things. Booking.com is a great one in hotels, but we really focus on flights. And so we have algorithms that therefore just shorten it much more, the time that you have, the total trip time, because we know from experience about what customers like and don't like. The second thing is right up on top, right where you see it, we have a little tab that you click on, a button, and it'll sort everything by shortest trip duration.
Now I want to click that button every time. What are you talking about? But that's not going to necessarily get me the best fare.
It's not necessarily going to get you the best fare. But what we do is, again, what we do is unique, is that we combine different airlines together to give you the best fare. So in your example of New York to Cape Town, you may fly from, we'll look at literally every flight that goes out of New York to every different destination.
That will connect.
And then from that destination to another one. So we may do, let's say, New York to Rio, and then Rio on to Cape Town. Or we may do New York to London, and then London on there, and we'll change airlines. And so we'll literally find you the lowest possible price, if that's what you want. But if time is what you want, right, then there's something different that we'll offer you. But we can find, and on average, we'll save you between about $250 to $350 per person round trip versus going to the domestic big carrier, like it could be Lufthansa or British Airways,
sure,
or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the British Airways model, going from New York to Cape Town, no matter what time you get to London, you have to lay over for 12 or 14 hours because their flight to Cape Town only leaves at night.
Exactly. And that's why we combine every different possible combination that's out there and then just present them very easily to customers and allow them to sort through that as well.
Let's quickly talk about, in the wake of what happened in Brussels, and we didn't even go back to Paris and Istanbul. Yep. We know that in this country, the bookings drop off almost immediately. People are saying, okay, I'm scared, I'm not going to go. What about in Europe?
Yeah, in Europe, the same thing.
Really? I would think that Europeans would be a little bit more experienced in this, would say, no, I get it, it's a way of life.
Yeah, so I guess it's all relative. Yeah. Meaning, it's very typical to see about a 20% drop-off in bookings from one day to the next. So, you know, it was the 13th of November that happened in Paris, the attack. And if you look at the 14th, kind of you get a 20% drop-off in bookings. The interesting thing is they come back quite quickly.
Well, especially in France.
Typically, in France. So it started staying at that kind of level for, let's say, a week. But between week one and week four, you get almost all of the benefit back. And then by week six, you're back at the same level again. So it's interesting. Travelers are very resilient, and they come back quite quickly to it.
So I don't want to say anything that sounds politically incorrect, but I've always said the best time as an experience to go somewhere is either after a natural disaster, act of civil unrest, or an act of political terrorism, because forgetting the rate, you're going to have an experience where you're not going to have a lot of crowds and people are going to be happy to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. So, and I'd just like to add one more, is after a big major global sporting event like the Olympics.
Because instead of going a couple of weeks after,
it's dead. They've got a lot of new hotel stock
that they got to
build for it.
Yeah, because they all build too many rooms. They always build too many rooms. They always do it.
And because they're new, they don't have that local connections because nobody knows the brand, so they're not filling them up after the Olympics. So if you really want to bargain hunt, go actually, absolutely, after
especially this year in Brazil.
Hello, this is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
Joining me now is somebody I've known for a long time in various incarnations, I might add. But usually airlines, now airport. I knew him at United. I knew him at Virgin Australia.
Correct.
And now he's the CEO of DFW, a huge Metroplex airport here in Dallas that is getting bigger all the time. Sean Donahue, how are you, man?
Hi, Peter. Great to see you.
I mean, it's one thing to say you're in the airline business and know about the airlines and live it, right? Making that transition to an airport seems like it's easy, but it probably wasn't.
Well, I was fortunate, Peter. In my career in the airline side, I worked at a lot of airports, so very familiar with airports.
Oh, you loaded bags?
And I loaded bags and all sorts of things in airports in my career.
So you were a ramper.
Well, I started as a clerk at United,
but
then I worked at O'Hare. I worked in Boston, New York, Denver, Chicago a couple times.
So you couldn't keep a job.
Yeah. People kept getting tired of me, so they kept moving me on.
So you understood the process, at least.
I did.
But what was DFW that was particularly challenging to you?
Well, when I was at Virgin Australia and I was recruited to come to DFW Airport, what really appealed to me was the fact that the focus of both mayors, the owner of DFW is Dallas and Fort Worth. So the mayors, you know, have a lot to say about the airport. And they had a vision about how we could grow this airport to be more of an international, more of a global player. And having lived in Australia for 3 years, I gained a great appreciation of the importance of a global perspective. And that's what really appealed to me from a strategy perspective. And then from an operational perspective, you know, my predecessor, Jeff Fagan, had a great reputation, ran a great airport. So I knew I was coming into a good situation.
Sure. I mean, you talk about global. If you take a look at airlift in this country, just domestically, it's shrinking. You know, there are cities that are really dying out there because the airlift is left, right? You take a look at Cincinnati or Memphis or Kansas City, Milwaukee, Ontario, California. I mean, right now it's cheaper to fly from Omaha to Oman than it is to fly from Springfield to Syracuse. And I'm not making that up.
I know.
So, and then you have the commuter flights that have always come in. And the thing is that bottom line is you have to figure out airlift here too.
Right.
At the same time, you see all these new disruptor airlines, if you'll call them that, who have figured out ways to come in and offer service to cities that may not be well served. I mean, for example, you can go nonstop from Las Vegas to Zurich now, right? On an airline that nobody knows called Edelweiss, right? And you have Norwegian coming in, right? You got the Gulf carriers here. They've come in from day one. I mean, they couldn't wait to come to Dallas, right?
Correct.
How much has your international long-haul traffic grown?
I just met with Customs and Border Patrol, and they shared with me a fascinating chart. So in the last 2 years, out of the top 10 U.S. gateway airports, DFW has been the fastest growing international airport at about 15-16%. And the other piece of that is we're really focused on making the customer experience great at our airport. And one of the things we're doing is the clearance through customs and immigrations. And we're using technology. So at the same time that our growth in international visitors has been up 15%, the time in clearing them has gone down 44%.
Now,
and that's a great story.
You know, there are certain things that they've done that I happen to be greatly supportive of, like, you know, global entry.
Right.
It's when the kiosks work.
Right.
Half those machines aren't working these days. I mean, it's crazy. But the concept is great. And when those machines work, boom, you're done. Who wants to wait, you know, 2 hours after an 11-hour flight? That's great. But there are certain things that are not in your control, right? Like the TSA.
Sure.
I mean, you have to work around them and with them, right?
Absolutely.
Here you have your hometown airline, you know, Doug Parker, the chairman of American, claiming, get ready, guys, it's going to be horrendous this summer. How do you fix that?
Well, we're working with the TSA in a spirit of partnership. We're fortunate, Peter, that we have 5 terminals at DFW, and therefore we have 15 different security checkpoints. So unlike a lot of major airports where there's one or maybe 2 massive checkpoints, we're actually able to disperse the traffic.
Yeah.
That helps us. That really does help us. Now, having said that, you know, this summer is going to be tough. There's no question about it.
Because of staffing cuts. I mean, they're down 1,100 inspectors in their system right now, and they haven't replaced them.
Right.
And the volume, as you know, is going up.
Absolutely. And one of the things we're trying to do at TSA, you know, PreCheck is a great program as well.
Yeah.
And there's not enough
pre-check
people. Enough people who have signed up for PreCheck.
And here's the problem. The TSA wants to go into the retail business and have people sample it, and then they're in lines they didn't even know why they're there. And instead of the guys screaming to take your shoes off, they're telling them to keep their shoes on. It's total confusion. You know, it's a little bit tough. The thing that I can't understand about TSA, forgetting the staffing, is their shift change ideas, right? Why would you close, and this is not particular to DFW, it's like, why would you close PreCheck at 7 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon? Wouldn't that be when you wanted to open, you know? Or why would you train your guys on the conveyor belt at 7 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon? That's when you don't want to do that.
Right.
Because they're going to look at every bag for 5 minutes.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, Roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now I radio clearance over.
That's Clarence over.
Over.
Roger.
Huh?
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. joining me now, and he comes to the summit every year because he's one of the big guys at the WTTC. He's the chairman and the owner of Silver Sea Cruises, my good pal Manfredi Lefrividovidio.
Thank you.
Did I get it right?
A big guy, why?
You have a presence.
Oh, because I have a presence, okay.
Of course. I mean, let's talk about the cruise industry because, you know, I was really stunned to find out recently, you know, that at a time when, you know, 1.2 billion people are going to cross an international border this year, only about 24 million people have taken a cruise. It's a really small fraction of the total economy. And yet, some would argue that the cruising economy is still almost in its infancy in terms of where you can grow.
Well, it's not where we can grow, where it is growing. If you look at all the orders which are being placed for new ships, which are always with more and more passengers, 6,000, 5,000 passengers each ship, that tells you the supply which is going to be there in the next 5-10 years.
I mean, we're talking every shipyard is at full capacity. I think the number I was quoted was 57 new ships being built. It's a lot.
Yeah, probably now it was 51, now it's 57.
Right.
And then how many passengers?
Now, your ships on Silver Sea do not have 5,000 passengers.
No.
You're in the 1,000 range or 900 range.
We're
right?
always there to take a little fraction of the growth, but it's sufficiently good.
Well, it's not even just about growth, it's a different style. I mean, you are smaller ships, you're more intimate, you're more upscale. You're not disgorging 6,000 passengers on a pier.
No, sure. I mean, we cater to a smaller fraction of the population. The awareness of cruising brings awareness also for upscale cruising.
All right, let's talk about that because the real, I guess, it's not just a question, it could also be a challenge. Where are you not going now in terms of destinations that you want to go? Or where is your audience telling you they really have to go?
I mean, we go pretty much everywhere. There are very few routes which are not being opened and where we don't go. I mean, there is Northwest Passage, Northeast Passage, which are the two...
Upper Canada
and Siberia.
Yeah, and you're not doing that yet.
Upper Canada, we did it 1 year. There are always risks that the sea will close, so you take a chance. And the other side, which is the Northeast Passage, you need permits, and in Russia, sometimes it's difficult.
Right. Africa?
I think we go wherever you want to go, we go. There's some areas which you have local wars, you don't want to go, so we don't go.
Of course, but I'm saying there are still opportunities in Africa of ports that most people haven't gone to yet along the west coast of Africa.
Most people do not know. Africa is not an exploited destination.
Right.
There's a lot to be discovered there.
And at the same time, of course, the elephant in the room, if you will, is China. It's gone, as you and I have talked about before, from a destination business to a source business, right? It's now...
It's gone from a tiny destination business to a potentially gigantic source business.
Meaning local Chinese cruising from China.
From China. I think that the most of them will be cruising around China. And then there will be a portion which will want to see the world on a cruise ship.
And every cruise line, including yours, is
looking at it in one way or another.
Or some cruise lines have actually built ships dedicated entirely just for the Chinese market.
Yeah, they're starting. They're starting either to change them and convert them to a Chinese market. What we assume is the taste of the Chinese.
And what do you think that is?
It will depend on the kind of ship. Upscale ships will mostly be quite the same. And the mass market will be quite different.
In what way?
They will have massive casinos. They will have... Big spas, they will have
retail.
Rooms dedicated.
Retail. Retail.
Shops. They will have rooms dedicated to play, what's the card name? Well, Wong, I don't remember.
Whatever the game is, yeah.
Yeah, they play cards, all the family gathers.
Oh, Mahjong.
Mahjong, yes.
Mahjong, yes, of course.
They all gather on holiday to play that game, and so that's going to be. There's going to be different dining options. You're going to have Chinese breakfast. You're going to have all of these things.
But you also, in addition to your upscale cruise line, you also have upscale expedition ships.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that to talk about Chinese, what they are looking for is iconic things. I think what is an interest for the Chinese is to touch as many countries as possible. So they want to think, to know, and to say that they have been in 100, 150 countries. So that's something which excites them. And another one is to go to destinations where you cannot go, a few people have been. So the Arctic, the Antarctic. But then it will go to a more normal approach. You go on vacation not to say that you've been on vacation, but you go on vacation to enjoy your vacation.
Well, to immerse yourself in a different culture, have a different experience. But first and foremost, they just want to come out of the gate running. And they just want to, they really want to just hit as many places as they can.
Yeah, they want to hit the places, and they want to go to iconic places and make a selfie that they've been there.
A selfie?
Yeah, selfie.
Oh, man, the selfies are driving me nuts.
With the selfie stick.
Unbelievable. Weapons of self-destruction. That's what I call them.
Of selfie destruction.
Of selfie destruction. Exactly. I was just in Venice recently, and I renamed the Bridge of Sighs the Bridge of Thighs, because everybody was thigh deep with selfies, trying to get a shot of them with a gondola going over. And I'm amazed nobody fell into the water. I mean,
it'd be fun once to see one falling into the water.
And I'm sure they will. That's the point.
As long,
as it's not us, because you fall into the water in Venice, you come out a different color. What do you think is the biggest challenge to the cruise industry right now?
Temporary challenges.
Yeah.
Temporary challenges is, of course, geopolitics always. You know, you never know what's going to be the next threat, the next problem. So, but the world lives this way. We've always had, we will always have some moments of hiccup. Either it's geopolitic or maybe some small economic recession.
But the instances
you grow through not a straight line, but through a zigzag line.
And the instances, let's say, of piracy on the African coast, they've gone down now.
It's almost non-existent.
Right.
Down Somaliland, the Strait of Aden, yeah, that's almost non-existent.
Right. I mean, it's over, just about.
Substantially over, yes.
So the
you
major...
See, it was a big problem, and now it isn't.
It is, because people addressed it. The Navy's got down there, and they got them.
Yeah, they got them.
Amazing. And, of course, one of your ships that I was just on the other night, the Silver Cloud, is now about to be repositioned as an expedition ship in the Antarctic.
Yeah, but that's a market which is growing at 9% a year. So we need to bring capacity in as fast as possible.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
My next guest is an old friend. We've been all around the world together, literally. And I first met him when he was the Minister of Tourism of Jordan. Was instrumental in allowing us to have access to then Prince of Jordan, who now, of course, is the King of Jordan, King Abdullah II. And his name is Akhil Biltaji, who now is not the Minister of Tourism. He's got an even better job. He's the mayor of Amman, Jordan. Nice to see you, Akhil.
Great to see you, Peter, and to be on your show. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time, but you know what? You haven't aged a bit. You look as young today as you did when I first met you. You know, it's interesting, you know, when people think about the Minister of Tourism job of Jordan, or Egypt for that matter, or anywhere in that region, it's a tough job because people tend to paint with one brush.
Yeah, you have the best assets in the world, antiquities, so all this time. But the circumstances in the area are not helping at all. Egypt is suffering. Jordan is suffering. The whole region is suffering now. Israel is suffering. I hope we'll get rid of those ISIS very, very soon.
And, yes.
And we'll get things back in order.
And by the way, having said that, as far as I'm concerned, Amman is still very much in order. I would go tomorrow. In fact, you and I were talking earlier about me coming over.
Exactly, Peter. We are the cool spot in a hot region, but sometimes
you're not branding it that way, are you?
Sometimes you have to, you know, the theme here, travel beyond boundaries.
That's WTTC, yes.
Right, is how to get there. That's what got me here, actually. I was very interested in the topic and the people. I haven't seen them for some time. You remember I hosted the WTTC back in Jordan in year 2000.
I was there.
King Abdullah was there as a host as well.
Yes.
So brings me back to empower and get some good stuff from you guys and energize myself and go back and make the city a great city, particularly this summer. We're counting on a lot of tourists.
But, you know, when I first went to Amman, and this goes back, 25 years ago, it was a sleepy place. It's not sleepy now.
No. It's 4.2 million people now. When you where the first, it was like 1.5 million, exponential growth. Yeah. It's amazing. But don't forget, we have I have 450,000 Syrian refugees who were waiting that, you know, they get back home. And that's why we call them guests. We don't like to call them refugees, so they can expedite their return. But it's a big city, bustling, 24 hours, and you'll love it. Just come back. And
I do. I mean, I had, and it's funny, talk about globalization. I mean, I had a great Chinese meal in Jordan, and you don't expect that, but there it was, right, in Amman. Where was it, Blue Fig?
Yeah.
Is it still there?
Yes.
Oh, my God. What a great restaurant that is. I mean, so many things, and you guys go all night. It's a lot of fun.
Right. It's still there, and so many other places as well. The Rainbow Street now is the hot spot in Andaman. But downtown, it's much cleaner, Peter. It's people are down there till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, safe as ever, clean. Trying my best to keep it a clean city.
What's your biggest challenge as mayor?
Traffic. And that's why I was looking at the Dallas toll system here. It's a company run by Spanish people, but it's a conglomerate. They built a $2 billion highway here on a toll system. And we want to do the same, not at 2 billion, but I'm doing it a 1.5 mile and another one in 2.5 miles, hopefully to get around the traffic congested areas. Traffic is my main issue now.
The other interesting thing about Amman, of course, is your airline, Royal Jordanian, because now you're expanding routes. You're flying to places you never flew before. And years ago, some very smart travelers who wanted to go to Israel realized the best way to do it was to fly to Amman and then go across the Allenby Bridge into Israel. First of all, you offered them a better airline deal, right?
That's right.
And they got to see two countries. Oh, the Israelis didn't like that at all. But the point is, you guys undercut them and you did a great job.
But again, if you want to enter the Holy Land, whatever that Holy Land is, you have to enter from the east. The sun rises from the east. So you land in Amman and then you go west into Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, the Galilee, and the rest. But do you ask me about my watch?
I do. Well, yeah,
remember that story?
I do remember that story. You and I were in China.
Nanjing.
In Nanjing, China. We were attending a conference and we both shared a car out to the airport. It was a very foggy day, which is a good thing in the end, right? Very foggy day. And we're sitting there. Am I right?
Absolutely.
And the plane was delayed because it was so thick you couldn't even see out the window. And all of a sudden, you had showed me your watch. Tell the story of this watch.
The watch is a Sinier. It's one of 36 watches. It's a Cartier. And it was given to me by a friend in 1984. So it's a charm. And there's nothing like it. Two sapphires.
Right.
And
reaches into his pocket and it's not there. Akel, who's the calmest guy in the world, was not a happy guy. And we were making cell phone calls back to the hotel trying to get something. And guess what? Thank God for the fog, because they found it and they came out to the airport and they gave it to you.
Hilton. Hilton organization.
And then they did it. And amazing story. And you still have the watch.
And the taxi driver was the happiest in Nanjing that day. He got $100 for it.
Yep.
But it's all about travel and how one could get to the manager and the manager get to the room service and the timing and all. And
they move quickly. It wasn't like you had to fill out a form and call them back in 2 weeks. They got it.
No time.
You know, that's one of the things about Asia that you get very easily spoiled by, because anything is possible.
That's right.
Anything is possible, and it happens quickly, which to me is like, you know, there's the old Groucho Marx line that you would never join a club that would have you as a member. And then you get to Asia and you realize they must be waiting for somebody else named Greenberg, because why are they being so nice to me? And then you realize that's who they are. It has nothing to do with you. And they really did a great job that day. I was so thrilled for you, because what a feeling of loss, because it was such an emotional and sentimental piece for you.
And when you asked me yesterday about the watch, what did I tell you?
You told me it's being repaired.
It's being repaired.
But you kept the chain.
And I have the chain.
He does. Now, though, when you fly to Amman, you could actually use Amman as a hub and overnight, a night, two nights, and then continue on the same route network.
Oh, that's the best thing that can happen now. Amman is a hub, and then you can reach Cairo, the Gulf. In fact, you can even backtrack to Istanbul if you want to. They're flying the 787, the Dreamliners, daily out of New York, daily out of Chicago, four times out of Canadian Montreal and Toronto. And the flights out of Amman, like on the hour, every hour to Cairo in particular. So it is the hub in the Middle East. What we look at Amman now, Peter, is that it's going to be the launching pad for the reconstruction of the Middle East. You look around Iraq, Syria, and the rest of the
all roads part, go through Amman.
Amman is going to be the launching pad for that reconstruction. You just the conferences, the events that take place, the presidents and prime ministers and leaders that come in, and King Abdullah is really doing your friend is doing a great job. And I understand he's very popular here in the States.
Very popular. Of course, as you know, he went to school here. He understands America better than most Americans. That's why he's such a good guy. He gets it. He totally gets it.
Where are the wagons?
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
Joining me now, he's become a regular on the show, an old buddy of mine who travels actually more than I do, hotel manager extraordinaire, hotel executive extraordinaire, Raymond Bixon. How are you, sir?
Hi, Peter.
You've been coming to this summit for a long time.
Yeah, howdy, aloha, and namaste. You know, that's the area that I cover nowadays. So, yeah, nice to see you, Peter. Nice
howdy.
To be here.
Oh, that's Dallas. Got it. Let's get serious for a second, because in the wake of the Paris shootings in November, in the wake of what's happened in Istanbul and Ankara, in the wake of what's happening in Brussels, some would argue, and by the way, statistically, they'd be right, that the incidence of this, the frequency of it, is increasing in terms of terrorist activity aimed at innocent travelers. There's just no doubt about it. And that's part of the deal. But in this case with Brussels at the airport and the metro station, you see almost an immediate drop off in bookings. The real question is, are we smart enough as intelligent travelers to realize that we can bounce back from this and it shouldn't affect our travel plans?
Well, I don't know if you can say that completely, Peter. I'd say that we are fortunate to be in the industry that we're in, travel and tourism, as we know that whether it's a natural event or an unnatural event of any kind of those proportions, that travel and tourism has demonstrated over the years that it bounces back. And because of the global nature and the cyclicality, synchronicity of our businesses today, that I'd say that, yes, it does affect you. I think it's a short-term effect. The traveler today is it's a global business, a global traveler. And it's an accommodation that we need to be as a traveler and also be as a supplier to make sure that our guests are looked after in any given way, shape, or form.
Right. It gets down to duty of care. But here's my question, because there's almost a conflict or a contradiction between security and freedom, between convenience and police state, right, in order to go from point A to point B.
Well, hospitality and security aren't exactly compatible per se in that context, because you're not going to a consulate or an embassy. You're going for a wedding, you're going for a function, you're going for a meal. And so it's not that type of security that one expects in a when you visit a hotel.
Okay,
actually.
So I'll be devil's advocate here, okay? Now, you've had experiences in India, some pretty horrendous experiences at the Taj, the famous shootout there in 08. And if you were going to enter the
9/11?
9/11, of course, I know. But I'm talking about just what happened in Mumbai. If I were to check into the Taj Hotel today, I'd go through a metal detector. If I was going to, right, that happened because of that, right? But how many hotels are proactively, and they don't have to like make it a police state, but how many hotels are proactively installing at least a visible security system to give people at least the peace of mind that they are being looked at?
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. It's really something that we have to embrace. And I had been in a general manager in New York for 16 years during 9/11, and 16 hours in the terrorist attack in Bombay, as you know. And so, you know, out of that comes a different way of the way we travel. I'd say look at 10 years ago when you came to the airport. And if they asked you to do those things 10 years ago, you'd be screaming at the top of your head. Today, you're stripped halfway down before you're even at the line. So it's what travelers have to learn to do, and hotels as well, actually.
Right, and that's the point that I'm making. I mean, for example, and I'm not trying to give anybody the wrong idea, but it bothers me to no extent that there's not a bellman in the world that wouldn't take $5 to watch my bag without ever inspecting the bag. You know, that wouldn't happen at the airport, but the hotels become a soft target that way. And the hotels that I've talked to will tell me off the record, well, they don't want to institute any more security like that because they don't want to inconvenience their guests. And my argument to them is, I think a rather large explosion killing half your guests is a rather large inconvenience in and of itself. So let's talk about what we can do. I'll give you an example. You may remember when they blew up the Marine barracks in Saudi Arabia and all those guys died. Well, under a military contract, there was a company that developed the most amazing thing, blast-proof wallpaper. Because people in those kinds of explosions don't get killed by the explosion, they get killed by the shards.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
So we watched them develop and then detonate this blast-proof wallpaper. And you see when they exploded the bomb, you see the wall just do this. Mwah. Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tokyo.
On second thoughts, let's not go to Camelot. It is a silly place.
Right. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
You had that terrible incident in Mumbai, and you reacted to the point where security became basically plan A, plan B, and plan C. Not to beat everybody over the head with it, but there's a visible security presence. And the hotels that you worked on, you had much better security. There's no doubt about it. And the proof of the pudding, of course, is that you haven't had an incident since.
Right. I guess it's both. It's visible and invisible.
Right.
I would say that if there are airports, for example, fly to Tel Aviv, you don't see anyone walking around with machine guns or sandbags with someone standing guard. But I tell you, they're there. And similarly, I think that whether you have plainclothes ex-commandos like air marshals in your hotel, that also exists today. And these are things which are there, but not there. And so you need to have that presence at the same time.
But, you know, there's a difference between a subtle presence and a presence that's in your face. So, for example, you mentioned the air marshals. I have to tell you, I have an issue with that. I have a real issue with that. Air marshals always sit in 3B. They all wear their Dockers pants, and they're reading their their Tom Clancy novel, and they're trying to blend. Guys, everybody knows who you are. And they sit in 3B, right? I understand why. Nobody wants to be in a window seat. They need to be able to get out right away. And there's one guy maybe in coach on selected flights. Emphasis on the words selected flights. They're not on every flight. If you truly want to make a statement about air marshals being on a plane, why not put them in uniform in the jump seat at the cockpit facing the passengers? That's it. Send the message that you want to send, and then everybody enjoys their flight. But no, they're playing a Clint Eastwood game of, are you feeling lucky today? Because they might be on the plane, they might not be on the plane. And I do not know yet. And if anybody's listening to the show and wants to argue the point, the number is 888-887-3837. I do not know yet of any incident yet since 9/11 where an air marshal has actually thwarted an attempt.
Peter, that's something that probably you would have a better idea than I would. And you'd probably want that to be more on the soft side rather than make it a point that
yes.
that happened. But I agree with you. I think, though, it's...
I mean, but think about what an air marshal does.
Yeah.
Your plane is either secure or it's not. The cockpit door is either locked or it's not. If you have an air marshal on a plane, you're letting people know you're still worried about the security on that plane.
Correct. Absolutely.
So they either got through security or they didn't before they ever got to the plane. Which one is it, guys? And when you see the failure rate of the TSA, 97% failure rate in detecting weapons. You know what a 97% failure rate would be in my case? End of a career. These guys still have jobs.
I think the great thing about it is that you have three airline CEOs on your show today or tomorrow. And so I think that'll be a really interesting question to pose to them.
And you know what? I'm going to tell you exactly what they're going to tell me. It's not our job. It's the government's job. They're going to dodge that question like they're going to dodge the bullet. But sometimes you just can't dodge the bullet.
Yeah, certainly I understand that. I think from the hospitality side that the international players that play in different regions, they do take security seriously. I think that they're really, but I say bigger companies probably have that opportunity and the bandwidth and as well as the ability to do that.
And you're right. The bigger companies do. And most of those bigger companies, I'm not seeing them do it yet. And if I were like a financial speculator, right, I would be investing in metal detector futures, because all you need is one incident in the American country, of the United States of America, in a major American city, where someone basically gets inside a hotel and does what happened in Brussels. And within 24 hours, every hotel will have metal detectors. Every hotel will have visible security. The question is, why don't they have it now?
Yeah, well, I think we've seen numerous areas of that in emerging markets, you know, in the sub-Saharan continent.
Oh, sure.
Obviously, in certain countries close to the action zones, because those are, again, softer, easier targets to go for, unfortunately. And in those regions, it's part of doing business.
Oh, listen, if you're an American-branded hotel in Jakarta, you have a metal detector. Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
The Four Seasons in Cairo has a metal detector. Yeah. I get it. Now, is the metal detector plugged in? I don't know. Is the medical... I mean, they have the machine is sitting there, but I don't know. But at least we have the... I don't think there's any argument that we have the technology to make it work.
You know, there was an old... The first Terminator movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and they're walking through a wall, and it's a giant... You know, that technology exists today. It does exist. So, yeah, you're right. It's an investment that we as an industry have to take seriously and do.
Well, listen, when the accountants run the asylum, everybody goes crazy. So for me, it's not a question of how much it costs. It's really a long-term view about how much it's worth. Yeah. And, you know, when a hotel says we don't want to spend the money on security right now the way you want it because we don't want to inconvenience our guests, one explosion in the lobby is going to be an exponential factor of what that investment was going to be.
It's part of doing business today globally.
Right. And the question is, who wants to step up to the plate and actually do it?
Correct. Yeah.
Proactively.
Right.
So anybody who's listening to this show, who's in the hotel business, who wants to take the opposite side view, I'm all ears. But you know what? I bet you can't make the argument.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.